chaos in Paris just hours before the Olympic Games opening ceremony.
Authorities are thinking something like 800,000 people could be affected.
Plus, Netanyahu's speech exposes division.
Netanyahu said Israel must retain overriding security control of Gaza for the foreseeable future to ensure it never again poses a terror threat. The Biden administration opposes a long-term Israeli troop presence in Gaza.
And later, an update from Kyiv and a conversation with White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby. Today is Friday, July 26th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. No injuries, but massive delays, frustration, and confusion in Paris as a coordinated arson attack set fire to train equipment just hours before the Olympic opening ceremony. I'm joined by VOA's Lisa Bryant in Paris for more.
For a lot of people who are trying to get in and out of Paris, it's just a huge, massive headache. I mean, I think that authorities are thinking something like 800,000 people could be affected. And this is as many Parisians are trying to flee the Olympics and go, you know, somewhere for the summer. And of course, lots of people are trying to get into Paris, you know, for the Games. So the timing is really bad. It sounds like French Paris prosecutors have already opened an inquiry, and they call it an attempt to undermine fundamental national interests. It seems like they suspect some kind of organized gang was behind it.
So let's take it back a step. What exactly did happen? Where are the fires?
The fires are in they've apparently affected a number of lines in France's Atlantic, Northern, and eastern areas. It sounds like among the things that were targeted, they happened very early. It sounds like very early Friday morning, like between 1 and 5 a.m. And cables, among other things, were targeted, and these apparently ensure the security of train drivers. And these were apparently set on fire.
But nobody was hurt.
No, not as far as we know. It's a problem for the rail system. But no, it's not like that there was a terrorist attack or anything of the sort so far.
So a problem for the city, a problem for the rail system, to be sure. But the elephant in the room, so to speak, is the Olympics. The opening ceremony is later on Friday. Have Olympic organizers said anything about security threats they've received or about changes they're making to their procedures?
I haven't seen anything on that. But of course, you know, there are also, you know, there've been just a huge, there's been a huge effort over days and weeks to prepare against all kinds of security threats. I think the French Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, said, you know, it's impossible to, you know, to predict and divert something 100%, but we can certainly plan for it. So, you know, there's a huge cortege of police, something like 45,000 or something for the opening ceremonies, just of police officers. 10,000 soldiers are deployed. They have people who have been inspecting, I'm sure still are inspecting, their sort of river police that are going up and down the river where the ceremonies are taking place. So I think that there are all kinds of efforts.
Well, I guess we'll leave it there for today. Lisa Bryant in Paris. Lisa, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Steve.
There are reports that a 40-year-old Russian man was arrested earlier this week in connection to a suspected plot to destabilize the Games. The Kremlin has denied any knowledge, and there have not yet been any statements from French authorities. Check voanews.com for the latest. Meanwhile, in Washington, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit continues to be the talk of the town. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris met separately with Israel's leader on Thursday as a sensitive moment in the Gaza conflict collided with an unprecedented moment in American politics. All this as Netanyahu plans to meet on Friday with former president and current Republican nominee Donald Trump in Florida. White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday brought Israel's leader into the calm eye of America's political storm. as the two tried to hash out a lasting peace to silence the suffering in Gaza. Biden said little.
Well, welcome back, Mr. Prime Minister. We got a lot to talk about. I think we should get to it.
But Vice President Kamala Harris took a firm tone after her own meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hours later, centering on the horror experienced by the people of Gaza. She urged Israel to take the deal on the table to end the fighting and free the hostages.
I also expressed with the Prime Minister my serious concern about the scale of human suffering in Gaza, including the death of far too many innocent civilians. And I made clear my serious concern about the dire humanitarian situation there, with over 2 million people facing high levels of food insecurity, and 500,000 people facing catastrophic levels of acute food insecurity. What has happened in Gaza over the past 9 months is devastating.
Her words were amplified by protesters outside the White House on Thursday, who object to the Israeli military's conduct in Gaza and want Biden to dial back his support. The White House said the meeting with Biden was productive, but didn't cite any breakthroughs.
This was a good discussion with the Prime Minister and his team. The President had a chance to lay out his concerns about where we are on the ceasefire deal and getting us to conclusion on that, as well as to talk about a range of other issues, Iran's destabilizing activities, the tensions at the blue line up with Lebanon, the need for more humanitarian assistance getting to the people of Gaza. There was a lot on the agenda.
On Friday, Netanyahu meets with Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. This trio of talks is obviously a delicate political balancing act for the Israeli leader. But some pro-Israeli analysts argue that Netanyahu's defiance of Washington has garnered results.
There's more likelihood of a ceasefire now than there was a couple of months ago before Israel went into Rafah. Vice President Harris told them they shouldn't go in or there'll be consequences. Biden didn't want them to go in. It turned out actually to be a pretty successful mission. They haven't finished Rafah, but they were able to quickly move a lot of the Palestinian civilians into other areas so they, the Israeli military, could fight Hamas.
Netanyahu's detractors, both outside and inside Congress, disagree. And as they like to remind the future president, whoever he or she will be, they have a say, too. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
As the world saw on Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to Congress highlighted U.S. partisan divisions on his conduct of the war against the Hamas terror group and some of his differences with President Joe Biden on how best to secure Israel's future. VOA's Michael Lippin looks at how Netanyahu's address and Biden's decision last weekend not to run for re-election may affect U.S. policy on the Israel-Hamas war in the coming months.
America and Israel must stand together.
Speaking to a joint meeting of Congress, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday urged the United States to keep standing with Israel as it works to secure the release of hostages held by Hamas and defend against attacks by other Iranian proxies. Richard Goldberg is a senior advisor at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
I think there was a lot in there for the White House to like. There was obviously not just the direct praise of President Biden, but again, this commitment to getting a deal done for the hostages, for a ceasefire, not for closing on a pathway to a ceasefire, both in Gaza and on the northern front in Israel, the opening to somehow getting to a normalization deal with Saudi Arabia.
Netanyahu said Israel must retain overriding security control of Gaza for the foreseeable future to ensure it never again poses a terror threat. The Biden administration opposes a long-term Israeli troop presence in Gaza, seeing that as inconsistent with its goal of helping Palestinians to achieve independence as part of a two-state solution to their conflict with Israel. Allison McManus is Managing Director of National Security at CAP Action.
Unfortunately, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to demonstrate, as he did yesterday, that he is not on board with that vision. And so this will be a continued challenge for President Biden. But I didn't hear anything in the speech yesterday that said to me that Netanyahu is bringing something new that might change Biden's trajectory.
By deciding not to seek re-election, the U.S. president has only half a year to use his powers to try to influence Israel's path. Again, Richard Goldberg.
When we look at the delivery of weapons to Israel, that, of course, he continues to control the spigots there of whether or not weapons come to Israel and how fast they come to Israel. So there's a lot of levers here politically, militarily, diplomatically, strategically, economically, that the president still has at his disposal for 6 months.
Thousands of anti-Israel activists gathered in Washington on Wednesday to demand an end to U.S. aid for Israel, accusing it of committing war crimes against Palestinians. It is a sentiment shared by some Democratic lawmakers. Dozens of others gave Netanyahu's speech lukewarm applause or boycotted it in a sign of sharpening divisions among Democrats on Israel. Again, Allison McManus.
There are some pretty serious concerns about how Israel has used U.S. taxpayer-funded weapons in its war in Gaza. Again, that's not going to jeopardize support for Israel's defense. But I do think it's made many lawmakers, particularly Democratic lawmakers, think twice about how quickly and how much continued additional support they might provide.
Netanyahu got a more enthusiastic response from Republicans for his call to give Israel the tools to finish the job faster against Hamas. It is not clear whether he will get them by the end of Biden's term. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
On Thursday, Kamala Harris said that she had put pressure on Israel's Netanyahu to help orchestrate a ceasefire in Gaza. However, her call for a ceasefire and critique of Israel's military approach has drawn criticism from Israeli politicians. Israel's far-right Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, posted on social media rejecting the idea of a truce. The Israeli finance minister accused Harris of capitulating to Hamas. For the people of Israel, however, it's a bit more nuanced. Avraham Laufer lives in Jerusalem.
I think that the meeting is important. I think it's important that Kamala Harris met our prime minister. It's a positive thing. It's obvious that we all want to end the war. We don't want this war from the first day. We are against it. It's a war that was put upon us. I hope that Kamala Harris is sharp enough to understand what's going on in the Middle East, because Biden was sharp enough, although he's old and everything, but he's sharp enough. Trump is sharp enough. And I hope Kamala Harris, with her moderate statements, will not abolish this the chance to bring to a treaty and the end of the war.
Meanwhile, another resident of Jerusalem, a Dutch national named Ernest Bugert, emphasized the importance of tackling the root cause of the conflict.
What I see here in this country is that people suffer a lot from this war. Nobody wanted this, but it is necessary. It's a fact that we as Dutch people living here, we are confronted with the same problem and with the same stress. So, talking about the war, you can say the war has to end, the war has to stop, but it doesn't remove the problem why this war started. So also as a foreigner living in this country, we woke up in the morning when 1,200 people were killed, okay? Brutally killed in the most terrible way. I've been seeing every video, every photo that was put on Telegram and censored. These were videos I was like, a member of, like, I looked at the channels of Hamas and Hezbollah. So I've seen what they put there. What they put there is their victories. So this has to end. This problem. So you can say end the war. No. End this brutal killing and end those who are responsible for it.
Meanwhile, Israel is seeking changes to the plan for the Gaza truce and the release of hostages by Hamas. It complicates a final deal to halt the 9 months of fighting. All this according to a Western official, a Palestinian, and two Egyptian sources. Israel says that displaced Palestinians should be screened as they return to Gaza's north when the ceasefire begins, retreating from an agreement to allow civilians who fled south to freely return home. Israeli negotiators want a vetting mechanism for civilian populations returning to the north of Gaza, where they fear these populations could support Hamas fighters who remain entrenched there, according to a Western official. Egyptian sources said there was another sticking point over Israel's demand to retain control of Gaza's border with Egypt in order to prevent weapons from being brought in. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Russia continues its aerial assault on Ukraine. We'll get an update from Kyiv in a few minutes. Up first, though, John Kirby, spokesperson for the White House National Security Council, spoke exclusively with VOA on Thursday. He said negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza are ongoing, but it's not time to celebrate yet.
I wouldn't describe it as increased optimism. I mean, obviously, we believe we're closer now than we've ever been to a hostage deal, but that doesn't mean it's done. Nobody's being Pollyannish. We've got to get it over the finish line. And as you know, the Prime Minister and the President both had an opportunity to speak to the families of the Americans that are being held hostage, and that was important, too.
He also addressed a continuation of current American policy should Kamala Harris become president. But again, he steered clear of a definitive statement.
Well, listen, I'm not going to speculate about the future. And those are questions for the vice president and her team to speak to. What I can tell you without question is that she has been a full partner in the pursuit of the policies that this administration has made clear are important to us. With respect to the Middle East and the war in Gaza. She's been a full partner, had conversations with Israeli counterparts on her own. She's been involved in virtually every conversation that the president has had with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, today she was out of town and wasn't able to be there for the meeting in the Oval Office, but as you rightly pointed out, she's having her own meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, very much in keeping with her very active hands-on engagement in this.
And finally, changing topics, he addressed the war in Ukraine and the alliance between Russia, China, and North Korea.
We have certainly watched with concern the burgeoning defense relationships between Russia and China, between Russia and North Korea, the way that it's manifested itself, particularly in Ukraine, Chinese companies now providing components for some Russian systems, North Koreans providing artillery shells and ballistic missiles. Obviously, that's of concern to us. And we have and will continue to take the appropriate action to make sure that these countries are held accountable for what they're doing in terms of, or their companies are doing, in terms of supporting the war in Ukraine.
And for an update on that war in Ukraine, we turn to our Kyiv correspondent, Anna Chernikova, with news about some new financial aid from the EU and another night of shelling.
The European Union announced the transfer of 1.5 billion euros of the profits from frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine. President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, confirmed this in X. According to von der Leyen, the money is intended to support the defense and reconstruction of Ukraine. She wrote that there is no better symbol and better use for the Kremlin's money than to make Ukraine and all of Europe a safer place to live. Also, according to Reuters, European Economic Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni said that the group of seven countries will probably conclude a framework agreement on providing Ukraine with a $50 billion loan at the expense of the frozen Russian assets by October. Meanwhile, Ukraine was under massive Russian shelling for the third night in a row. In the early hours of July 26, Russian forces launched a massive drone attack across Ukraine. Ukrainian air defense reported the destruction of 20 of the 22 incoming drones in the Kherson, Sumy, Zhytomyr and Chernihiv regions. Also, the Russian army hit the Donetsk region with an Iskander ballistic missile, the Ukrainian Air Force reported. No casualties were reported. Russian forces launched the drones from the territory of Russia and occupied Crimea. Talking of Crimea, local residents and media channels reported the sound of explosions and fire before dawn on Friday. Explosions were heard in the area of the Saki airfield in Novofedorivka. Saki airfield is one of the main airfields Russian forces use to launch jets to conduct shelling of Ukrainian territory. It is also a place with a high concentration of Russian military equipment and modern air defense systems. The General Staff of the Ukrainian Armed Forces confirmed the attack on the Saki military airfield in occupied Crimea. The department emphasized that the airfield was under the protection of modern Russian air defense equipment. Now the Ukrainian military is clarifying the information about the damage caused. The Russian military and the Crimean authorities do not comment on this incident. In the meantime, the Ministry of Internal Affairs of the Russian Federation announced the arrest of a man suspected of blowing up a GRU officer's car in Moscow. During the interrogation, the detainee admitted that he allegedly started cooperating with the Special Services of Ukraine in February 2023. According to him, he was offered to eliminate the officer, and after that, he said, he received the components of an explosive device. He claims that he was promised Ukrainian citizenship and a reward of $10,000 to $20,000. Ukrainian authorities did not comment on that. The Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, Dmytro Kuleba, commented on the results of his visit to China. He said that as a result of the negotiations with his Chinese colleague, Wang Yi, he received a clear signal that China is not looking for temporary solutions, but is working on a sustainable and strategic solution to the problem of the Russia-Ukraine war. In particular, Kuleba noted that the first and most important point is that China supports the territorial integrity of Ukraine. According to him, Wang Yi very clearly and repeatedly stated that China's position on supporting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine is inviolable. The second important diplomatic point, according to him, is the position regarding the establishment of a stable and just peace in Ukraine. Previously, President Zelensky said that the trip proved that China is not planning to supply Russia with weapons, however, did not provide any details. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
As wildfires are raging across the western U.S. and Canada, Jasper National Park in Alberta, one of the world's natural wonders, is in danger. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has the story.
To those in Alberta and around the world who have experience the magic of Jasper. The magic is not lost and it never will be.
Alberta Premier Danielle Smith choked back tears at a news conference Thursday as she described the impact of a raging wildfire that has devastated the western Canadian tourist town of Jasper.
We're seeing potentially 30 to 50% structural damage. We don't know particularly which structures have been damaged and which ones have been destroyed, but that's going to be a significant rebuild and significant displacement for a long period of time.
Jasper is in the middle of mountainous Jasper National Park in the province of Alberta. The town and the park, which draw more than 2 million tourists a year, were evacuated on Monday when officials estimated there were up to 10,000 people in the town and an additional 15,000 visitors in the park. One major concern for responders is if the fire damages the Trans Mountain oil pipeline, which carries hundreds of thousands of barrels per day of oil from Edmonton to Vancouver. Alberta Wildfire Information Unit Manager Christy Tucker.
There are 176 wildfires burning in the Forest Protection Area of Alberta. 54 of those are out of control, 50 are being held, and 69 are under control.
According to Parks Canada, the Jasper fire was caused by a lightning strike on Monday afternoon and fueled by strong winds. Environment Canada is forecasting rain for Thursday, which might help firefighters. The Jasper fire could be one of the most damaging in Alberta since a 2016 blaze that hit the oil town of Fort McMurray, forcing the evacuation of all 90,000 residents and destroying 10% of all structures in the city.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters reporting for us. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.